Hi, welcome back. Here we'll proceed by looking at the resonance and the sound of your soul, its stately otherworld imprint, if you like. In the last session, we talked about how the mirror world is opposite us, and in that, there is an alternative you. It is composed of your innermost subtle feelings that come from your subconscious mind. We say it is the real you, the authentic you. The alternative self is sacred. It holds the perpetual memory of you. That inner you has a resonance, and that resonance is like a sound. So you could say your soul has a tone that typifies what it is, and that tone may be very ancient and mysterious, and it may resonate at a level that is way beyond anything you've ever heard here on Earth. For beyond the mirror world are other worlds. Each of us is spread through layers of eternity, like strips of chocolate through the center of a sponge cake. And the resonator of that celestial tone here on Earth is your heart. It throbs out the feelings that are remembered in your soul, and those are emitted initially from your heart chakra. It's a pulse or a signal, one that is U-shaped. That pulse is very fast moving. It travels through the etheric waves that surround your body and out from there to others. Those signals you give off imprint reality around you, just as Professor Emoto's water crystals are changed into beautiful snowflake shapes or horrible ghoulish images, depending on the feeling of the word that is written on the glass tube that holds the water. If your heart is very big, in the sense that you are a very open and loving person, one that has come to accept humanity unconditionally with no personal judgment, if you have proved that by serving people, and if you see life as a sacred gift, then it is possible that the tone of your soul could resonate for many miles, right across the city. You would have the silent power to bend what has become ugly and dark back to beauty and symmetry. When the heart tone is very beautiful, it's very deep in its resonance. The closest here on Earth is the sound of a crystal bowl. I'll just play it for you so you know what I mean. You can hear how the resonance carries you off to another place. It's a healing tone. If you listen carefully, you can feel yourself going down the center of the sound to another dimension. Beautiful, isn't it? When you listen to the purity of that crystal bowl, you know, it's a pure note of C. It has this pristine, uncluttered quality to it. So that is what our soul really is. It's that sound. When the world ends, there's going to be one thing and one thing only, and that's the sound of water. So when you listen to the sound of water, you're listening to the symphony of the end of the world. And inside that C note is this absolute pristine purity, this uncluttered purity. Like when an opera singer hits a high C, that is the most inspirational part of the song. If you have ever listened to, let's say, Madame Butterfly, some of the famous songs out of that opera, and when the opera singer hits that high C, it carries you back to God. Your whole skin starts to tingle. And it doesn't matter if you're into heavy metal and rock or whatever, an opera singer that can hit that note carries you out and away. And so it's the simplicity of that note, the uncluttered beauty of it, that is the nature of the eternal spirit within us. That's not to say that heavy metal is evil, but it's like a clatter of the chaotic ego, isn't it? It's the music of chaos. It's the music of disgruntled, pained people that are going to clash and bang and make as much noise as possible. And there is a place for heavy metal. You know, there's lots of people that love it. And it talks to them in some way that they appreciate. Like, for example, jazz is the music of despair. So jazz was invented by the black Americans, you know, coming up from the fields and so on, and they sang about the pain or the torment of their life, and sometimes they sang about beautiful things, but you can't listen to jazz unless you want to do a bit of despair. It's the music of despair. And so when you're listening to jazz, you go into and you process perhaps the despair of your life, but you understand it for what it is. So there's the pristine beauty of the bowl sound, and then there's the clutter and the chaos of life. So here now, in this session, we'll look at your etheric energy and see what can be done to make it prettier and more resonant. raising the vibration to oscillate faster, we hope to disengage from disease and discordant dark energy and align to a purer, more beautiful world. Let us discover what the song of your soul sounds like. But first, let me talk to you about etheric fields and biophotons. 20 years ago, I discovered I could see the etheric field around trees. It's the flashing oscillation of the life force around all living things. Then I saw it around humans and animals, and finally, when my sight of it got stronger, I realized it's around everything, plants, bugs, etc. The etheric is full of fast-moving vortexes and striations of hazy light. Later, I came to see many more complicated ramifications in the fields. In many ways, Carlos Castaneda was right when he said that we walk around in a luminous egg. The etheric stretches out several feet in all directions. I learned that our human feelings are in that field. What we normally describe as feelings are just sensations, electrical pulses to the brain, and the emotions are reactions to those pulses, pleasure, pain, happiness, anger, etc. But real human feelings of love, hate, frustration, joy are all in the etheric. That is how you can read people accurately and sometimes help them. You pick up on the hidden feeling they emit by touching their etheric with your mind or by placing your hand on their chest, for example. Here's a bit of the scientific background to the etheric reality. Researchers have discovered a new particle, a very weak one, called a biophoton, which is part of the light spectrum. It is measured with very sensitive equipment. It seems to be given off from all living things. It is thought to be light emitted from the DNA. The discovery of biophoton seems to confirm the existence of the etheric field around our bodies as a scientific fact. A photon is a packet of light, so a biophoton is a particle of light given off by a biological system, like the human body. The light given off from a glowworm would be another example of light from a biological source. The biophoton was discovered by medical scientists in Russia in 1923. They originally gave it the strange name of mitogenic rays, but nothing much came of it until they were rediscovered by a German biophysicist called Fritz Albert Popp. He was the one that said the biological light came from the DNA and that it had a coherent quality, meaning that it was like laser light. The reason laser light travels a long way is because the particle of lights are in a tight, coherent field, bunched close together. And so the light doesn't spread out and dissipate like the light beam of an ordinary flashlight. The coherence is the same for the etheric light around your body. That is why you can fire your etheric using your concentration and the power of your will. You can send it across the street, and someone that can see the etheric, even a little bit, can watch you doing it. Professor Popp has suggested that certain diseases may be due to a drop-off in resonance in the biophoton field emitted by the body. It has also been suggested people are influenced by remote sources of etheric light, which has led to research into distant healing, and it may explain why certain magical healers can breathe on people or touch them and make them better. It's also why we seek to raise the energy of the etheric and make it go faster. The researcher William Hamilton III has said, and I quote, "This light emission is an expression of the functional state of the living organism, and its measurement, therefore, can be used to assess this state. Cancer cells and healthy cells can, for instance, be discriminated by typical differences in biophoton emissions. In other words, sickness is darker than health." After an initial decade and a half of basic research on this discovery, biophysicists of various European and Asian countries are now exploring the many interesting applications which range across such diverse fields as cancer research, non-invasive early medical diagnosis, food and water quality testing, chemical and electromagnetic contamination, cell communication, and various applications in biotechnology. In theory, the biophotons of the etheric field can't be seen by the naked eye, but in subdued light, the etheric is clearly visible, and there are thousands of people all over the world that see the etheric on a regular basis. I've never thought that the sight of it took any particular spiritual or psychic gift. All you have to do is to learn to tilt your head slightly when viewing things in subdued light, like a tree, say. At dusk, look at the top of a tree, and then move your attention a little way to the right, and stare at the sky there. And without moving your eye, take your concentration back to the top of the tree, and you'll see the life field. You'll see the etheric of the tree. If you're interested in morphogenesis and the fields of information around living things, like the etheric, you might like to check out the work of biologist Rupert Sheldrake. What Sheldrake says is that we're all surrounded by fields of information that he calls morphogenic fields. And those fields direct the way an organism develops. So a giraffe is giraffe-shaped because it is surrounded by a morphogenic field that has the history of all the giraffes that have ever lived on Earth. Professor Popp has also speculated that biophotons are message carriers and that they may be responsible for ESP and non-local jumps of information in quantum fields. I'm absolutely sure he's right about that. Here in this particular session, I've come up with suggestions of little etheric exercises that you could do. Later on, I'll talk to you about the possibility of tapping a person with your mind, where you read how they feel. You basically take an imprint from their feelings, and so your etheric is linked to their etheric. Their etheric is linked to everything. So it's through this biophoton field that you're linked to all information. Professor Popp has said that he believes the biophoton is a carrier of non-local information. Non-local information is when quantum particles jump and they disappear in one place and appear in another place. Or non-local information would be like when you intuitively know that your friend is sick or in need of help, or just when you intuitively know that the phone rings and you know it's Aunt Maud before you even pick it up, you know it's her. Yeah, not because she always calls on Thursday at 11, but you just get this hit. It's Aunt Maud. And so what you find is that gradually, as you let go of the sort of ivory tower of analytical logic, you enter more into the sideways space of feelings, that you become connected to the global feeling. And so you can be fully aware how it feels in Palestine today, or fully aware of the problems that are happening in the ecology of the tundra or whatever. You become connected to the Gaia of the planet, and you're connected to people. And so it's through this biophoton etheric field that we develop ESP and intuition, and I live my whole of my life like that. I don't really make intellectual decisions. I try to look around corners with my etheric intuition, with my feelings. So I'm more looking at how does a thing feel. I can look at a person and I can tell you parts of their life story just from their feelings. Not how they look. They could be dressed in a bunny rabbit outfit, you know? But just the imprint that they make walking through a lobby, I can tell you where that man is going with his life. It's completely about gaining more energy for yourself, because not only are you acutely aware of the humans that you are in service to, but you're acutely aware of what you need. And so you'll get these strange little pieces of information that suddenly tell you eat 6 fennels, you know, and you think, fennel, I never eat fennel. Like, what is fennel? You know, but there it is in the supermarket. And you just go and you eat 6 fennels because inside fennel, there's some mysterious molecular structure that your body desperately needs. So it's an intuition about your body. It's an intuition about business opportunities. It's an intuition about people, especially people that sort of look okay, but they're not. They're going to let you down or rip you off or whatever. And then it's an empathy. I don't know really quite how to describe it, but it's like when you watch a bird, the bird is flying inside your soul. And so when the bird tips its wings from one side to the other, you can feel that wing shift inside your heart. You can feel the spirit of a little dog. Its heartbeat is inside your own heartbeat. So it's an empathy for humanity and it's an empathy for nature. The ivory tower is created by electricity. And it's created by the ego and its incessant needs. It's sort of the opinion of the personality. So your personality has opinions, and those opinions feed the ivory tower. The ivory tower is always a situation of separation. The idea for the ego is to separate itself from humanity. So the ego wants to be higher than other people, even if it's only 2 or 3 other people, but it still wants to be higher, you know? Like there's certain sort of homeless people that are sleeping in the park that want to be higher than the other homeless people. It's this idea of separation. So the ivory tower creates a personality that wants to be separated from humanity. And there's a reason in quantum physics for that, because in quantum physics, nothing exists until you observe it. So a particle is in a hyperstate, a potential of being somewhere, but it doesn't actually appear anywhere until somebody actually observes it. So the walls of a room are not really there until you look at them. When you're not looking at them, they return back to their hyperstate. So they could be where you last saw them, or they could be in Tibet. There's a potential. All right, it might be many trillions upon trillions upon trillions to one, you know? But scientists know there is a very faint chance that those walls are not there next time you look, and in fact, they're on the road to Tibet. So, in the fact that solidity is created by observation, the ego intuitively knows that. So it requires observers to make it feel solid. So the rock star needs observers and minders and bodyguards and massage therapists and agents and promoters and limousines, and they've got a gang of 70 people that travel around with them, observing them, making them special. Yes, sir, no, sir, what do you want? So in that specialness, the ego seeks to raise itself up, and what it's trying to do primarily is to distance itself from the destiny of humanity, and the destiny of common people that are unimportant, let's say, for example, is to die. The more important a person is, the further they are from death, because unimportant people, let's say in countries where human life is not respected much, if a guy dies in the street, you step over him. So the destiny of a common man is to sort of just be sort of plowed under and die, whereas the ego of the ivory tower is the ego of somebody that's terribly special, that's very highly observed. So they go through this illusion of importance, illusion of immortality. They create for themselves this idea that they are immortal. That is why Hollywood stars go through surgery and Botox and transplants and hairdos and lift your breasts and lower your knees and whatever they do, because it creates this illusion, I am an immortal. And that's what the ego wants to do. It wants to become a demigod. It wants to reach immortality. And one of the ways that it reaches immortality is to create observers. And the observers feed the ego electricity, the tower goes up, and so the ego feels it's distanced from the destiny of humanity. So in many ways, in the journey beyond enlightenment, we don't seek to acquire any new energy, really, because we've got massive amounts of energy. It's just that when the ivory tower isn't being held up and sustained by our concentration, we naturally come down. When we land on the grass, so to speak, you know, it's known as the lunatic on the grass in these old writings. The lunatic on the grass is basically the lunatic that fell off the top of the ivory tower. Okay, then he or she starts to go sideways, and that's where all the perception is. I've talked in this series about the transverse wave of light, the zigzag wave that is going at 90 degrees to the forward motion of light. Well, it's in that zigzag wave that you are connected to all of humanity. So you could say the forward motion of light is the ego in the ivory tower, zooming along miraculously at 300,000 kilometers a second, and the zigzag motion of light, the sideways motion of light, is our empathy, our feminine spirit. It's the yin compared to the forward yang. It's where we automatically join with humanity, and in that joining, we join into what Jung called the collective unconscious, but we also join into the force field of the mirror self, which is the force field of the etheric, so you're connected to everybody. You can feel their pain. When you start to touch that empathy, it's an incredibly glorious experience, but also it creates an enormous compassion inside of you. Because rather than seeing somebody as a hard-nosed businessman who perhaps is rather predatory, you see them as a wounded child that's scared, that's grabbing all the toys like he did when he was three. So in that empathy, you do see and you can feel the pain of humanity. And I have to tell you that that sometimes is tragic. You know, you can sit in the lobby of the hotel and you can just observe the pain because you're watching slaves. You're watching human slaves that are being whipped by their egos. They're being whipped to perform. They've been whipped to succeed, to earn money, to consume way more than you ever need. And so you're watching basically a slave ship. You're watching men and women shackled to the floor of a slave ship. and they're walking through the lobby, and so you can empathize with that pain. Of course, if they talk to you, then you can perhaps suggest that they don't do it anymore. But all torment is self-inflicted. I suppose I would say that in the empathy, it's love, but it's more than love, because you are their pain. Their pain's your pain. In other words, the world can't end until they feel okay. The world can't end until every single person is made well. You're connected. So in that connection, you can't get away from the fact that they're hurting. And I think the important thing about other people's pain is that you can't buy it. And you definitely can't make yourself responsible for it. And the wise sort of fringe dweller, spiritual warrior, knows that they're not their brother's keeper. They're not here to interfere. The greatest love that you can offer another human is to let them go, is to let them be, is to make them right. You know, love them as they are, even though you know that they're about to go over a cliff, psychologically, let's say. We can't buy their pain, but that doesn't mean that you don't have an empathy for it. But then the converse is true, where you see people celebrating, people that are very light-hearted, and there's a festival, and everybody in the village is happy, and there's dancing, and, you know, the mariachi band or whatever, then again, you pick up on their joy. So it shows you how important it is to guard that imprint of what you are, to guard it, to become disciplined with it, so that when you are ratty and crabby and upset, you've got to look at, why am I tormenting myself? What's going on here that's making me feel like this? And try to change that imprint. Not blame others. You know, people that say, ah, it's my husband that's making me upset. Hey, excuse me, it's not your husband. Yeah, but he's such a this and a such a that. Wait a minute, he is who he is, and he's probably just a little boy. You know, let him be. It's your reaction to him that's making you upset. It's our reaction to life. When you're making other people scapegoat for your own discomfort, then you realize that you're projecting your shadow. When you go, let's say, what I call very white, so you're right and you're correct and you're the honest one and this one's the bad guy, then again, you're in your shadow play. When you think you're going to your whitest, most righteous, most preserved state is when you're going to your complete darkness. It's your ugliest state. Because if you have to say so-and-so is dark, what you're saying is, I'm dark. The action we take is we take responsibility. So you would ameliorate that by saying, look, I know I'm calling you dark, Harry. I'm sorry, I love you. It's actually my own darkness that's coming out today because I'm dog tired. Or it's my darkness that's coming out today because I'm really pissed off and I've had a hard day at work. Or it's my darkness coming out because I feel my energy dropping and I think I'm getting a bit of flu. So mainly it's the act of being responsible because I can't make you angry. I can do things that might stimulate your anger, but you have to agree to be angry. So I could do things that were really irritating, but you could say, wow, that's just Stewie. He's kind of being a bit foolish. He's a bit weak today. He's a bit dishonest. It's like when people rip you off, you can be angry that they've ripped you off. Or you could say, well, they're weak. You know, they better have the money. They probably need it. So what can people do? They can realize that the imprint they make today is the pain that they will receive in 3 weeks' time, or the glory. For example, in road rage, you know, you might be seething because people are cutting you up, and you might eventually think, cracky, I don't want to drive because this is potential for a disaster. But of course, not driving isn't the answer, because that's just letting go of your responsibilities or whatever, or letting go of a tool which is useful because it gets you around the town. The answer is to remember that all road rage comes from your own self-importance. Because if they want to get in line, and if six other people want to get in line in front of you, you could say, this is a beautiful day for waiting, and you let them go first. So it's only your self-importance that says, this place in the line for the traffic light is my place, and I'm an important person, and I've got to get there 9:10, and I need to be there. But in fact, you're not an important person. You're a divine, eternal, spiritual person that can wait in line forever. So if 100 cars want to go ahead of you, let them. So all road rage, in fact, is not the person that's raging, but the person that is being raged at. And usually what happens is the road rage is some other rage that you had 3 weeks ago. So you were raging at your kids for nothing. Okay, they left a few toys on the carpet, and you put your foot on the truck and fell over. So you raged at the kids for an hour about how messy they are. And then a month later, some guy's raging at you, waving a gun at you on the freeway. But you say, oh, I was so innocent driving along the freeway like the angel of mercy in my perfect white, white, white. But in fact, that's just your own rage coming back. In other words, you are a transmitting and receiving station of etheric downloads and imprints. Some are graphic, some are mental, and some are in the buzz or the formatting that I spoke of. There's so much information that you may not be aware of as yet. There's a wonderful story going on in your soul that is unfolding from deep within. So you should never worry about where you will go and how you will get there. You'll know. Trust. Learn to trust. And the more you align to a soft world and a spiritual way, the more you will see it come miraculously into your life. We're all in the morph, and it is in us. And the record of your life so far is in there as well, and your future possibilities, in all their glory, even though that future may be somewhat hazy right now. So we're all in a hologram, and possibly the whole universe is a hologram, and you are in my molecule, and I'm in your molecule. That might be a critical realization one day. You're in a loop. What goes around comes around. We all have a rudimentary understanding of that as we experience it day to day. But what is the technical reason for energy and karma coming back to us? Your mind imprints your etheric biophotons, and they go out as light from you, and they imprint reality around you. They especially imprint other people who are mainly made of water. Those people will react negatively or positively towards you. And as you react to their reaction, you pump more subtle feelings into your mirror self, adding to your stored memories. And through these stored memories, your mirror self changes, and it tends to drift back and forth in the mirror world to parts that reflect your current state. So it will go from sacred, happy, and blissful to angry and hellish. Gradually, the mirror self starts to pump energy back towards you here in the physical, which might be like the little bruises that the women get. And that returning energy reflects in your body and your mind. The return energy is what you put out emotionally and mentally into your etheric weeks ago. Eventually, you take your own stuff back as an energy hit in your physical body. Pain, disease, and a lack of luminosity, perhaps. They are consequences of a lack of awareness. All disease starts in the mind, traveling through our etheric and on into the mirror world, where it solidifies and bounces back, developing speed all the while, to come back to us several weeks later. A lot of the warp comes initially from fear. It's weird that our evolution is so much to do with processing fear. Here are a few etheric moves for processing and transcending fear. First, you should never be ashamed of your fears. We humans are small and fragile. Poised as we are in an enormous universe, any one of a dozen things can take us out at an instant. Yet overcoming fear is part of learning to love, for we cannot love when we are afraid. Fear leaves no space for such positive emotions, for it swamps your mind and closes your heart, and your etheric goes grey and dull looking. The more open you become, the more vulnerable you are. It's a test. By letting go and becoming more and more open, you allow yourself to be open to danger, uncertainty, rip-offs, and of course ridicule. Can you live in the restrictive environment of the ego's fears and the rules it will impose upon you? Can you truly express yourself as a complete person, a spiritual person, if you don't take risks and go for it? So the only way forward, in my view, is bit by bit, as fast as you can accommodate your insecurity. Here are a few ideas with some etheric moves which you might find helpful. Most persistent low-grade fear is not due to psychological issues or a poor state of well-being. It is often only due to dehydration. Most don't drink anything like enough water. The water in alcohol and beverages doesn't count. We need about 8 8-ounce glasses of clean water a day, which is just less than 3 liters. Otherwise, body cells become dehydrated, and fear and insecurity increases dramatically. Why dehydration causes fear and anxiety, I don't know. We just observe that it does. Most people would not be scared or depressed if they were better hydrated. If you rehydrate your body, you will see a dramatic improvement in days. Drink 8 large glasses of water a day and take 3 lecithin tablets spread out during the day. You'll get them at the health food shop. You can take lecithin granules if you like instead of the capsules. The lecithin helps the uptake of water in the cells. You will notice a substantial reduction in your levels of anxiety after about 3 days. In total, it takes about 3 weeks to completely rehydrate the body properly. Once you've done that, remember to keep your water intake up and increase it whenever you feel fear and insecurity creeping back in. The hydration discipline is so simple, it gets rid of most low-grade fear and it helps with mild depression. As you discipline the ego and begin to control it, your life becomes less fearful. Meditation helps a lot, for it's the only way to properly discipline the mind and stop it thinking so much. The less you worry, the more open you become. The more open you become, the more etheric light is infused within you. The less energy you waste and burn, the more transcendental you will feel, and so the less insecure you will be. Most fear comes from suffering from low energy, which may be mental or physical. But either way, a lack of discipline and too much low energy stuff, confrontation for example, sets up fear of collapse. That is why the unknown poses such a problem for many people. They worry that they might not be able to sustain themselves financially, physically, or emotionally in different circumstances. However, when you're powerful, you can express that power wherever you go. Changing locations and circumstances means little to you, for you're strong within yourself. If you're insecure, do these things. 1. Exercise every day for 20 minutes if you can. Even gentle exercise like walking is better than no exercise. If you don't exercise, you will get scared. Remember, extra fat in your body is stored fear or stored pain. It's ancient memories in your flesh. Certainly, we all put on a bit of weight in middle age, but you have to lose that by the time you get to your late 50s or early 60s, as there aren't very many old, fat people. To be healthy in old age, you have to be normal and thin. I would be the last person to offer you a weight loss diet. I'm sure you're fed up with all those fads and the hype that surrounds them. Except to say that all the transcendental adepts that I know, the true morph warriors, are almost all vegetarians, as they don't like to kill to survive, and they don't like to ingest the fear that is in the animal's body meat, so most of them live substantially on raw food diets. When food is raw, it's alive, and it has light in it. I'm not an expert on these things, but I have cooked food in the winter when it's cold. But I do go on a diet that has a lot of raw food as the spring comes along. If you want to study up on raw foods, check out the books of David Wolfe. Enough said on that topic. 2. Try to rest and sleep. So many modern achievers and high-action modern families suffer from sleep deprivation. Sleep and rest whenever you can, and allow yourself at least 1 hour a day of quiet time to ponder your life and your strongest moves. Not having time to yourself can make you anxious. Life requires us to be brave. Nurturing yourself and resting and being calm and in control develops security and personal strength. Also, having less responsibility and activity helps. You can soon lose yourself and become fearful if your life is too cluttered. I know many people that sold up and quit the life of the yuppie whirl, and they took their little suitcase and floated off to discover themselves. Of course, if you have families and children, you may not be able to do that, but maybe you can adjust your life to be less active. Often we work hard to pay bills, and in the act of working, we create more bills. We buy things, but if you think about it, everything you own, in the end, winds up owning you. I can't remember who said that, but he or she is right. Not long ago, I took my suitcase and headed out on a journey of 60,000 miles. I was away for 3.5 years, and I spent a lot of that time on a bed watching the morph. But I learnt more in that time than the whole rest of my life put together. Choices, ones that carry you beyond stress and fear to redemption. I learned a lot about the nature of terror and fear as a firewalk instructor. My associates and I walked about 8,000 people over the years. It was interesting how people handled the unknown. I would tell people just before they walked the fire that their ego would quit and seemingly leave, and that they would walk as if in a dream, often not recalling what happened. I tell people that because of the altered state that fear puts one in, they would probably want to walk the fire twice. Few of them ever believe me, yet on every fire walk we facilitated, about 65% of the participants would go over the fire a second time. Life is often like the moment just before a fire walk. Fear wipes your consciousness and you enter into a self-induced hypnotic state. Life passes you by. Years can go by without you ever realizing the true you. Time flies when you're stuck. Awareness is a gift granted to the courageous. You can't get rid of fear entirely, but you can come into control of your mind, and by disciplining yourself, you feel more confident and more secure. It's not hard. Fear is a bad habit for most people, one that they can learn to control. Here's a quickie. If you suffer from nightmares, stop eating protein after about 6 in the evening, as most nightmares come from food, especially heavy protein. Just eat very lightly early in the evening, no heavy stuff like steaks and so on. Here's a few etheric tricks that will also help you when you're really scared. 1. Make a fist and thump yourself fairly forcefully in the sternum, center chest, as many times as it takes to change the energy of the heart chakra. That opens it to more energy. Don't punch too hard. The sternum is quite fragile, just hard enough to affect change. 2. Put your thumb and your first two fingers together on both hands and tap both your cheeks simultaneously an inch or so below your eyes. Do this vigorously and quickly. There's a meridian there. Tapping changes the energy flow. 3. Put one hand over the other and place them both over your navel, pressing inwards gently. You can do this laying down, facing up if you wish. Etherically, fear flows out of the solar plexus. It gushes out like rain through a storm pipe. Putting your hand over your navel stems the loss of energy. The less energy you lose, the more calm you become. 4. Lock the fingers of your hands together and place them on top of your head across the middle, covering your crown chakra, and pull your arms downwards, pressing yourself down into the ground. That pulls your etheric back down and it inhibits your imagination from flying off the handle. If a child is a bit hysterical, just place your hand firmly on the top of its head and press down. Hold the other hand lightly against the child's navel, pressing inwards, both hands working together simultaneously. The hand on the top of the head is good for calming kids and getting them off to sleep. You can also touch them etherically at a distance, as long as you can see them. Imagine yourself with an extended arm. See yourself reaching out etherically and place your etheric hand on the child's head mentally using the authority of your will. Imagine yourself pressing down on the child. In fact, I use this technique quite a bit when lecturing to stop babies from crying when mothers brought cranky babes into the lecture hall. 5. If you're panicky, let's say you're too speedy and out of control with anxiety, lay down with your head to the north and your feet to the south. On the ground, in the dirt is best. Try to get as much of your skin in contact with the ground as possible. If conditions permit, take off all or most of your clothes. Then visualize pushing the fear down through your body into the ground, anchoring it. Say, Mother Earth, I'm giving you back this fear of mine. Another alternative is to allow natural running water to run down your spine, like, say, laying down in a stream. The water trick also works when you feel your energy dropping, like you're getting the flu. When I was traveling on the road as a lecturer, I used to get in the shower and I'd have it nice and warm. And once you're hot, I would flip it quickly to the cold water and let it run down the spine and then go back hot and cold, and do it 4 to 6 times if you can stand it. At least 3 times anyway. In conclusion, all fear is the fear of loss. Or the fear of death, not necessarily physical death, but the death of things that we are familiar with, our relationships or our job or perhaps a situation that's familiar that is about to change. Start to train your mind, if you have not done so already, to see change as beneficial and necessary. Nothing persists forever. So don't hold on, be prepared to release aspects of your life and allow the law of flow to come into your life. Do you see where we're going with all of this? It's an uncoupling process. First you look at your inner self and the existence of the mirror world self, and then you see the clusters you are in and how they hold you, and you glimpse the possible liberation of your soul. One of the important questions we came upon as we went that way is, how will you imprint reality as you go along? What is your purpose here? That could be answered by, I work and pay rent, and then I work some more, and I rush to accumulate things until I have no more energy, and then I'll die. But what kind of purpose is that? Most people are just taking up space and generating pollution. It makes you wonder how long the soul of this planet is going to stand for that. So can you see how developing a higher purpose, you develop a spirituality beyond the mundane? It seems to me that the purpose of life should be first to use your income to buy experiences for yourself, so you have knowledge and experiences that you can share with others. And then surely the main purpose of your life is to be of service. Not just service to any children and family members that you might be caring for, but service to humanity, or service to the animals, or service to this planet in some way. You see, as I said before, all that will count for anything when you die will not be how many mortgage checks you paid or how much money you left your family, but what did you do for this planet? Did you serve? How much did you love them and help them? Through service, we operate our heart space and we install energy in the hologram of life. It's a bridge we build for others and ourselves. In service, it might seem that you're supporting others, but in fact you're learning to honor and serve the eternity within yourself. It's a form of remembering, a higher remembering that is imprinted in your soul, and there are signposts all the way, taking us back to what we already know in our ancient memory. We are raised to think that this life is all about us and how cozy and comfortable we can become. But if you think that life is just about you, then you've been sorely misled. You haven't gotten to a real sophistication in your comprehension of things. In the journey beyond enlightenment, what we're looking at is the paradox of the fact that the more things you have, the more you imprison. Somebody marvelous, whose name I can't remember, said, you know, everything you own in the end winds up owning you. And that's a fact. You buy a fancy car, you can't drive it. I used to have a Rolls Royce, several. But hey, you couldn't drive the bloody Rolls-Royce because you couldn't park it, because somebody might scratch it. If you scratch a Rolls-Royce, it's $1,000 to get a door painted, you know? Maybe more. So it's almost like, hey, I'm now sitting having dinner worrying about my car on the sidewalk. Hey, what I should have done if I'd known in those days, but I was young and foolish, I should have gone out with my car keys and scratched the bloody door myself. That way I wouldn't worry about having a scratched Rolls-Royce because it's already scratched because I scratched it myself. Then I could have a nice dinner and enjoy my friends and be in love with the situation. The paradox is that these, let's say, for example, let's go back to the analogy of pop singers. You know, they create this ivory tower, then they've got these mansions, but then they fear loss. So now they need bodyguards that are charging them $800 a day, and they need dogs, and they need surveillance, and they need huge fences. And they need to protect themselves, and then you can't just ring them up because they're terribly important, so you've got to ring their agent in New York, and so on and so forth, you know? There's a wonderful story of an opera singer who was in a limo, and she's known for being unbelievably capricious and sort of edgy and a real sort of, you know, mad diva causing trouble all the way. And she was driving in this limo in L.A., and it was too cold in the back. And so she phoned her agent in New York to call the opera house, to call the limo company, to call the driver, to tell him to change the air conditioning. Because she couldn't tell him from the back seat to the front seat. It's like an urban legend. And I've been told that it's true. She's so important, she can't say to this poor guy, you know, he was driving the car, hey bro, would you mind turning the air conditioning up or down or whatever she wanted? So she called her agent in New York, who called LA, who called the limo company, who called the driver. She imagined the driver driving along and he goes, yes, what can I do for you? Oh, the lady in the back wants the air conditioning turned down. But that's the ivory tower. In a way, it's very much the epitome of the ivory tower. So you can't talk to this person as a real person. No, you've got to go through a whole performance to get to them. Do you follow me? It's the isolation, and isolation destroys your soul. You may not as yet understand that this life has very little to do with you, except in the marginal sense that you have to care a little for your upkeep day to day. But that may only amount to a cup of rice each day. After that, your real journey starts elsewhere. Focusing on you and your needs is not the be-all and end-all of your life's purpose. You may have had an inkling of a proper purpose over the years. Spirit may have talked to you in quiet moments. The part of your mind that thinks it's running your life is laboring under a delusion. Yes, the mind pretends to run your life, but that's all part of the con. It controls nothing, even though it will insist the opposite. Your life has nothing to do with your mind, even if you think it does. You can become part of something much bigger and more glorious once you give yourself away. You'll see it. I've often said that the spiritual journey through life is just 4 feet long. You travel 1 foot downwards from your head to your heart, and 3 foot outwards to embrace the first human you meet. That is the ivory tower coming down, so you allow yourself a tactile contact with the reality of humanity, its soul, so to speak. In the end, it's all about deliverance, and that deliverance is more important than anything else in the world. You deliver yourself from forgetfulness, then you deliver others that are drawn to you. For if you don't deliver them, who will? They don't have much of a chance without you. Think of that. They can't escape until you agree to help them escape. Now you might say, listen up, Stewie Bubba, this deliverance business is a bit dodgy. Why do I need it? And I'd say most people care little for deliverance, but that is mainly because they can't see what is waiting for them up the road, so to speak. We're surrounded by a world of dark energies, and they're all over this place looking to trap people. It's a war of control. Control over the human mind. If too many people start remembering, those dark energies will lose their domination. Now, I know some think that if they join one religion or another, they'll be instantly delivered, but that idea is fraught with problems. A religion can offer you the hope of an elitist deliverance, but no such thing exists. It's a bit of a ghoul trap. Spiritual seekers have the biggest ivory towers because they play to an elitism of us and them. And the us and them elitism says, generally, you know, we're special and chosen by God, the sage, the guru, the adept, to survive. We are the ones that will survive. The common man will not survive. So it's back to the ivory tower. We are the ones that have been made right by the will of God or by the holy book or by the sacred, and that makes us very different and very special. And that's why some spiritual groups sort of wear white clothes and a white diaper on their head, you know, and they wander around doing spiritual new age being, you know. But in that whiteness, they're really, really dark. Because to distance yourself from humanity and to be elitist and chosen and special is fatal. It's part of the ghouls. It's part of the devil. It's like you're not elitist. You're not special. There's nothing special about you. And yet we're all special in the sense we're a child of God and we're unique. But in effect, there's nothing special about me or you or anyone. And the idea that God will select one group of people over another is piffle. It's complete rubbish. Have I been selected by God to survive? No, you haven't. Well, if you haven't, you're lucky. Because you probably will survive. The meek will inherit the earth. The Beatitudes. The meek will inherit the earth. That's it. Spirituality is an empathy. That's all it is. It's an empathy with every single person you meet. And it's a special empathy with those people that you hate. You know, those people that are really aggressive and violent and nasty. It's like, it's an empathy for them. I know a man, he's Italian, he's in his 50s now. He's very abusive. And he's been violent all of his life. He used to get involved in a lot of fights and he caused people pain. He loved beating people up, especially if they were smaller than him. He enjoyed inflicting damage. That was his thing in life. He's also a sexist. He sees all women as placed on this earth to give him service and sexual pleasure. And he's always been a virulent racist. He hates people that come from Africa or Asia, people that have darker skins. And he makes no bones about shouting out his racist ideas in the company of others. He's a Roman Catholic and very religious, and he's also scared of death. But he believes his Catholicism will save him, and that he'll go to heaven after his death because he has supported the church and attended Mass and so forth, tagged along, so to speak. But I think he may be up for a bit of a reality check. I feel for him, because there's nothing I can do to change him. He likes his life. He's very rich and powerful, and he'll never give it up. He knows I'm a spiritual writer, and sometimes he asks me about my philosophy. And I try to tell him, but he's not the kind of person who would listen. I've known him for 40 years. I don't see him very often, but I try to love him and not judge him or criticize him. And I've never once ever told him he's wrong in the way that he deals with people. It's not for me to fix him. And I couldn't rescue him if I tried. And anyway, he would never ask me. Strangely, this man has redeeming qualities in that he's very funny and generous, and he makes a big show of splashing out and paying for dinners and so forth. But that is his outer mask. His inner self is like something out of The Sopranos, and he's staying in the cluster until he dies. He's sort of transdimensionally abducted. He sees himself as holy and good, and yet his imprint on life is ugly and dark. You see, his mirror self is trapped. It is as if he is possessed without ever knowing it. He lives in the section of the mirror world reserved for violent, racist mafiosi that like to express their power by hurting others. They use intimidation to reign supreme over others. They think they're special, and power and money drives that illusion of elitism and specialness. Once you comprehend the loop you're in, you get out and you watch how you're imprinting reality as you go along. You are a snowflake, a beautiful snowflake, or you are a dark picture of evil, polluting everything you touch and making people sick as you walk past them in the street. We live in a sea of energy. If you put out a truly soft imprint and you love the world, everything you touch, everything you breathe in, has the basis of remembering. And the next person that touches the same shopping cart, for example, will also begin to remember. It's the heart space or tone that you leave behind you everywhere you go, becomes a doorway for others. They sit on the same bench and their mind will drift, and they will slide to a 90-degree world without knowing it, and suddenly they will hear faint sounds of their soul calling to them, asking them to step away from cold and tight and pain towards a freedom. They start to remember. And that's our function here in this world, is to help people remember. Thoughts jump. How many times have you been thinking about something obscure and the person next to you mentions the very thing you've been thinking about? Silent communication generally comes about when you're thinking in the direction of another person rather than concentrating inwardly towards your own thoughts and emotions. You have to set your mind to one side and concentrate on others. It's hard to stop your mind talking. It likes listening to itself. But it can be done with a little bit of discipline. Silent communication of the human soul can be in the form of prayers or silent affirmations for the well-being of others. Then there's the actual mental dialogue that is spoken in the direction of another person. It is a telepathic transfer of energy, and hopefully it is a silent dialogue that offers love and encouragement of some sort. In Paris recently, I was watching a middle-aged lady walking into a cafe. She looked a bit stressed out. I asked her silently, "Are you afraid?" She turned towards me and nodded. I asked, "Are you sick?" She shook her head. I breathed love into her heart. She passed behind me and took a seat. Minutes later, a tall man in his 70s came by. He looked in pain. I asked silently, "Do your lungs hurt?" He grabbed his shirt with his right hand and he looked at me helplessly. It was the look of a small child begging a grown-up for assistance. I told him silently, "Drink lots of water, clean water. It's the key to everything." Walking through the customs hall in Philadelphia Airport, the official stopped me. He wanted to look inside a metal flight case I was carrying. I touched him on the side of the head mentally, and projecting a soft, warm feeling, I said mentally, "It's safe. I need to go now. Thank you." He hesitated and pointed to the case as if requiring that I open it, and again I said silently, "It's safe. I need to go now." He pulled his hand back and said, "Are those computers?" And I answered audibly, "Yes, sir." "Okay," he says, and he waves me through. When you talk silently to people, look at their right temple and blank your mind. You just tap them with your thoughts, like reaching out with your hand to touch them at the side of the head. Blink once as the thought goes across, or expel a short breath. The more silent and subtle, the better. The harder you try, the less effective you are. Soft and subtle, that is the way. Morphic resonance is the language of force fields interacting with each other. Your brain is a complex force field that stores and receives information in the form of wave packets. We are a holographic brain inside a holographic universe. There's no distance between anything. We're all connected. We're inside the same global mind, the global subconscious. Once you know you can talk silently, then start doing it and remember to watch and see if they twitch, as those twitches will tell you that there are pulses coming through to them from the mirror world. Sometimes they don't twitch, but they move their eyes upwards. That means they're entering a mild trance at about 4 to 7 cycles a second. If the incoming pulse that is coming to them is pain-related, they might wince. What you will learn is that if you ask a question of them, they will often show you the answer, like the man with the bad lungs that was grabbing his shirt. You watch their lips carefully and you watch their eyes. The telltale signs are often in the lips and the eyes, and you will soon see that you can read people easily. Try for the obvious first. Anger is easy to spot, as is arrogance. Remember, arrogant people tilt their heads back as if the nasty smell of lesser beings is under their nose. Violent people have a madness in the eyes. They give off a strange bend in the etheric. And if you ever see people that have white under their pupil, between the pupil and the lower eyelid, that is often the sign of a true psychopath. It is known as Kung Po or Sampaku. I used to teach that to my kid and his mates, to increase their awareness in case anyone came into the playground that looked like that. If we could walk in the street, I could show you all of it in several hours or even less maybe. But you can teach yourself. I did. No one showed me. I learned by watching. And as a person passes, reach out etherically, extending your arm, and grab a small molecule from their center chest area and pull that back towards yourself real fast and blank your mind. And don't be overly influenced by what clothes they're wearing or how they look. As the etheric energy comes back to you, ask yourself, how does this feel? When you go into a restaurant or cafe, ask, how does this feel, this place? And the memory of the walls will talk to you. How does this feel? It's always in the feeling. In the etheric state, you have the ability to step into the subtle energy of another person. For example, I talk about moving your etheric, your subtle body, out of your physical body, turning that subtle body to face you, and then stepping backwards with your etheric into the physical body of another person that you're talking to, for example, like dropping backwards into them. Visiting another person etherically in this way is okay, providing you're not manipulating them or making do things that they don't want to do. It's a way of joining them, being with them, concentrating on that person. In the end, concentration is a form of love. When you're focused upon a person, you're in the act of loving them. This dropping backwards into another person's energy is like the tapping, except they are close to you at the time, not across the street. And you're only ever in there for a few seconds. But while you're in there, you can hear the sound of their soul. You can hear and feel who they are and what they're feeling at that very moment. You have enormous power. Some of it lies in and beyond your stored pain. And some of it is here right now, and some of it is only available from time to time. It just blips through when needed. It's only at the very end, many decades from now, that all the spiritual warriors and fringe dwellers that have the remembering, each will decide and they will have to step across and stay there and not come back. Or they can choose to stay here as teachers and healers and wise people. But no one knows what world they will inherit. It may not be the world we know today. But once you are bigger than the dark, then you are safe. Come now, let me tell you about the inner and outer matrix, for you will have to deal with both of them one day, and without the knowing of them, you may be greatly lost. Come, let us go to the fourth session.